Welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the Pediatric GI Podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. My name is Peter Liu, and I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Jason Silverman. So Jason, how are things going today?
They've been better, but I have a voice such as it is today. For everyone listening, I have been sick with the plague for the last week because families with young children, illnesses go around. So, but I actually have a voice because I didn't have that earlier this week.
You know, to me, your voice sounds beautiful.
So, you sound great. Thank you. But in your biased opinion, I'll take it though. I appreciate it. My kids make fun of me and they're like, what are you saying?
I will say, like, our producer Corey has been doing an amazing job hiding the fact that we have all been sick at some point in the past few episodes, including, I guess when I get sick, I have like a old person COPD cough.
Yeah, man.
But thanks Corey for making us sound healthy, but this one we cannot hide.
Yes. Good luck with this one, Corey. we'll need some special AI tools to fix up my voice completely. Oh,
but we do have a kind of announcement.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, heads up to people in a certain part of the world. Watch out for superstar Dr. Silverman coming to a place near you.
Well, I don't know about the superstar part, but yeah, I'm going to be at BESPGHAN. In Bristol, UK, next month or this month when this episode releases. So March 20th to 23rd in Bristol, UK, the British Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition. The organizers were really, really nice and invited someone from our group to represent Bowel Sounds and give a talk about podcasts in medical education. And I'm the nominated speaker representing our group. I'll be there. So please come and say hi. If you're in the UK and you're attending BESPGHAN, please come and say hi and introduce yourself.
And we guarantee that your voice will be fully recovered by then.
Definitely.
Yes.
Definitely. I will sound 100% better than this.
But that's incredible. And I think also, like, I mean, for all of other GI people, Bristol, that's a historically important town in our field.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I imagine that the chart will be making its appearance, hopefully. Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll be a little disappointed if it doesn't, to be honest. But
do you think non-GI doctors in Bristol know that their city is famous around the world for stool form? Maybe not.
No.
Probably not.
No.
Okay.
All right. Probably not. But I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited.
Yes, you're going to have an awesome trip. It's going to be amazing and you will be fully recovered. But today we have an amazing episode. One of the best, if not the best episode we've ever had.
It was really good.
Our first episode with someone who is not only a leader in the field, a legend, a giant, but also a movie star. Wait, I guess he's not really the movie star, but
no,
our only guest who's had a movie made about him.
Yeah.
Indirectly.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Featuring such famed stars as Jennifer Garner and the George Clooney equivalent from Mexico. This is according to our guest's words, I think. And Queen Latifah, I believe.
A star studded cast.
So of course,
bottom line, none of us have a movie made about us. So
no way.
Head and shoulders above everybody.
Oh yeah, I mean, he said that the producers actually like came to his office and took pictures of all his diplomas and stuff to make it accurate in the movie, which is wild. If you don't know already, this is none other than the legendary Dr. Sam Nurko, finally making his way to the Bowel Sounds podcast.
We have wanted him on the show for a long time.
Yeah, he's a hard, you know, he's in demand, and we also try to spread out all our motility topics. But today, so Dr. Sam Nurko, he is a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's the director of the Motility and Functional GI Disorders Center at Boston Children's Hospital. He has held so many positions and done so many things. But as we talk about, he also was featured in a movie about one of his patients called Miracles from Heaven. It's pretty cool. So we were very lucky to have him on with us to talk about what I feel like is a very important topic that we don't get too much training on, in fellowship that we needed to address.
Yeah, absolutely. So we had a chance to talk through all about the approach to and the use of neuromodulator medications in DGBI. And I just really loved his approach and how he frames this with families and patients, and how he thinks through which agents to use and explain why we're using these medications and how we're using these medications with families. I thought it was excellent. I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners will too.
Yeah. And he also talks about his journey from being a medical student in Mexico and not matching into residency. And then now he's a professor at Harvard. So there you go.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, without further ado, before Jason's voice completely gives out,
on to the show.
Dr. Nurko, thank you so much for joining us on Bowel Sounds. It is a huge honor to have you on. We've been wanting you on as a guest for a very, very long time to talk about this important topic. Thank you for being here.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm looking forward to this. And I think you guys should be very proud for what you've accomplished. So congratulations to you.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Like Peter said, we are really excited to have you. You know, we've been seeing you at meetings and listening to you and learning from you for what seems like a really long time. But there might be some of our audience who don't know you. And so we're going to start with what some people find to be the most challenging question. And that is, how would you describe yourself in one sentence?
Don't forget, I'm from Mexico, so the sentence may be longer because Spanish is a very, you know, different language than English.
Truly. No problem.
I would describe myself as being a proud immigrant, a good clinician, a clinical researcher, an ally for underrepresented minorities, especially women. But overall, I would describe myself as a lucky person, that I've been given great opportunities, and I'm surrounded by great partners at work, and I have a great family, and now I have grandchildren, which has really changed my life.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic. I love how often our guests have gratitude or lucky as being part of how they see themselves, because that's fantastic.
I also feel like so many of our ultra successful guests describe themselves as like low key or just a normal person. And so anyways, I love it. So I had a little bit of a different question than our usual standard question. So a few years ago, you gave a talk to our group about your personal journey as an international medical graduate from a pediatrician in Mexico City to where you are now, you know, leading the motility program at Boston Children's Hospital, your professor at Harvard Medical School. So that could be an episode on its own, but do you mind giving us a little bit of insight into your journey and how did you develop your interest in pediatric neurogastroenterology and motility?
As you said, it's a complicated question, but yes, I was born and raised in Mexico City. And, you know, I grew up after my grandparents immigrated. So, you know, I was exposed to hard work and education was the most important part. When I was growing up, coming to the U.S. to do a residency was like the goal for most people. And that's what I strived for. So I was lucky enough to be able to, you know, complete all the requirements, and I applied. And I think it's important for people that are listening to know that the journey was not simple. Being a foreigner, I had no idea, but the American system did not do my homework, so I did not match. So there you have, you know, the first adversity in a way that you can find, which is what most of our journeys will show people. You know, where you see us now, that was not the pathway, right? So I was lucky enough that somebody took me out of the match at Boston City Hospital, and my journey in the U.S. started. And as Peter described, the shock of the language, the culture, the different illnesses, that was very challenging at the beginning. But on the other hand, coming from a different country also gave me a different perspective on things. So it became a very nice bi-directional road where I was learning at the same time as people were learning from my own culture and what I am. I always loved children. I love that children develop. And you can see them as a pediatrician, how they start from being little babies until they become independent people. So that growth and development, and that's what I always had a passion for. That's what I like about pediatrics. And coming from Mexico, I was very exposed to diarrhea, malnutrition, and other problems. And that's how my interest in GI started. Once I became a GI fellow and then an attending, I realized that what I was really interested in was movement. And that's how I became a motility specialist. And I don't want to date myself. But when I was doing my training, all these disorders of gut-brain interaction that we call now were considered motility disorders. And if you look at the history, everybody was talking about the sigmoid dysmotility and the contractions. And so I was growing up in the area where motility was important, but eventually lost its real role in being the main pathophysiological basis. And we started to focus on pain and other aspects that drive these functional disorders that we call DGBIs. So I'm part of that generation. That's how I switched from motility to neurogastroenterology.
Ah, I see. That's interesting. I always wondered why they were lumped together, you know, like achalasia and IBS don't seem like there's too much in common, but I guess they all deal with nerves and so anyway,
with motility disorders, and then we realized it was too simplistic.
For sure. And we're going to talk a lot about DGBI today. But before we get into our main topic, we have one more question to ask. We have to ask it because Peter and I, we talked about this before you came on. I hope you don't mind, but we're pretty sure that you are our only guest who's had an actor play them in a movie. So could you tell us a little bit more about that and what that experience was like?
Oh, absolutely. I would say even I have people that know me know I have a little cameo appearance in the movie. So not only did he play me, I am in the movie, actually. Wow. Not as Dr. Nurko, of course.
So I will share that one of my colleagues, when I told him that you were our guest and we were interviewing you today, his only response was, he's a movie star.
You are correct. The movie is called Miracles from Heaven. This, you know, what you're going to hear me talk about serendipity and how doors open and close all the time. So one of the serendipities and fortunes of my life was that one of my patients, you know, had a major experience with her health and wrote a book that became a best-selling book and eventually became a movie. And the book reflected her experience. And one of the main things that they reflect in the book, actually, and then in the movie, is the interaction with the physician, which happened to be me, and the importance of the multidisciplinary care and listening to them. And I think that's the most important part of the movie, right? It really portrays the chronic suffering of patients with chronic illness. And that was very powerful. So the experience was sobering. You have no control. I'm used to, you know, in motility, as you say, I'm a professor at Harvard, so I have control over certain things. But over there in the world of movies is a completely different background where I was not familiar with, but it was very interesting to see the interaction and how both worlds collided in a way. And I had an open door to really change lives in other areas. You know, education have an impact. I did not have any say on the main part of the movie, and they warned me. And you should see, I did not see the movie until the day it was premiered. And they warned me that I was not going to be happy because Hollywood is Hollywood, right? So there's aspects of the movie that are not perfect. But there were a few scenes that they did want to get right. So I had some influence on the movie. And you can see it's the first time that the use of psychological help in patients with chronic illness is portrayed in a major movie.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, you know, after long discussions with the director and all that. The other thing that became very obvious to me is you have a responsibility when you're in that role to really shape the new generations. And at least in my Hispanic background, it was very interesting to see how, and a lot of people talk to me about this, is how it was good for the Hispanic population that's growing to see that Hispanic people can be successful and can be professionals and can be doctors and not what they are usually presented in some of the movies, right? Some of these stereotypes. So that was the most important part. And the actors were fantastic. Everybody wanted to get it right. And everybody spent a lot of time talking to me about what the message should be to people that are going to ask them questions. So it was a great educational opportunity to really change lives in another area.
Wow.
That is so, so cool.
I mean, I heard, my understanding is the actor who played you is considered the George Clooney in Mexico. Is that accurate?
He's a very comic. Actually, this movie allowed him, actually, now he does a lot of American movies. Wow. His name is Eugenio Derbez. He's a very well-respected actor, and yeah, it was fun to be with him and talk to him. And
that is so cool. All right. So I guess we do have to move on to our topic today. And it is an important topic. So we'll talk about one that's relevant to one of the most common disorders that we see as pediatric gastroenterologists. So functional abdominal pain predominant disorders of gut-brain interaction. So disorders like IBS and functional dyspepsia. So we know they're common. We know they can have a huge impact on a child's quality of life. And I think we all know in our field that these can be very challenging to treat. So before we focus on these GI neuromodulator medications that we're talking about today and their role in the treatment of children with functional abdominal pain, can you give us a little bit of an overview? So how do you think about the approach to treating a child with functional abdominal pain, and where do these medications kind of fit in our management approach?
It's a very, very important question. And as you are mentioning, it's a very common diagnosis. Unfortunately, in a way, is not one of the most liked and loved diagnoses when you're practicing. And that's a big challenge, right? These patients can be very challenging and complicated in their psychosocial aspects. And we are used as doctors to follow a lot of what's called the medical model, right? This thing that you want to have a test, you want to have a result, you want to have a therapy and make it go away. And that's not what DGBI is. Right, the DGBIs, which is, again, I want to stress, is the new name of what used to be functional GI disorders, is disorders of the gut-brain interaction. What they reflect is a complex interaction between many different things, right? As I mentioned before, between, the motility disturbances, the visual hypersensitivity. Now we know a lot of microbiome relationship with food, immune function, and how everything is processed in the brain. So they are complicated issues that one needs to understand when one tries to come back to the topic today, which is what does it mean to try to change the way the nerves and the brain interact with each other? And I think it's very important for people to realize that DGBIs are a real disease. I just want to say that the pain is real, and you always have to be positive with the families. You have a real pain. Pain is a subjective experience. You cannot judge how the kid is, but it's real, and it's a positive diagnosis, meaning you don't need tests to know that you have this. And from all my talk today, if people could just internalize to give a positive diagnosis and to frame testing as a way to look for triggers, not the reason for the disease, you are going to avoid a lot of problems. Because if you do testing to find the reason and the test is negative, like it will be most of the time, the family asks, okay, what's next? And what's next? And what's next, right? On the other hand, if you frame it, I'm looking for triggers. Okay, I didn't find this trigger. You have a DGBI. I'm going to treat it. It's much easier to understand. And, I think that's a very important, simple thing in the clinic that people can do.
Excellent. Hey. I wanted to say amen after several of things that you just said there. It's a positive diagnosis, and it's not all in their head. I feel like families hear that so much, even if those words don't actually come out of our mouths.
100%.
I can step on because it has to do with the neuromodulation. The issue of the head comes from this dualism in medicine, right? Where you had either a medical problem or a psychological problem. So if every test is negative medically, therefore it has to be in your head.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the reason that the functional term was associated with all these prerogative psychological issues. And that's why it was changed to disorders of gut-brain interaction, to try to get away from that perception that these things are in your head.
No, I think that is so important that patients and their families, they hear, they feel heard. They have that sort of commitment from the physician team that they view it in the same way, that the symptoms are real and there's a clear path forward. And so speaking of treatment as a path forward, Peter mentioned the term neuromodulator use. And some people, when they hear the term like neuromodulation, maybe they start thinking about electrical stimulation. Maybe that's just Peter because of his focus. But what do you mean if you were using the term neuromodulator medication in the context of functional abdominal pain or pain predominant DGBI? What do you mean by that term? And what are the main categories of, I'll use the term antidepressants, are used for children with functional abdominal pain?
I'm going to step back a tiny bit more before and say, if you follow the pathophysiology of this, you know, I mentioned that it's an interaction, right? And you can have peripheral visual hypersensitivity, or you can have central nervous system involvement. So when you talk about neuromodulation, that's the concept of trying to change the way the nerves are firing and the way the circuits of the brain are interacting with each other, right? And that's the term of neuromodulation. I said I wanted to step back because if you really look at DGBIs, we do a lot of neuromodulation using peripheral things that have nothing to do with the brain. And that's the first concept I would like to give, right? Neuromodulation does not mean antidepressants. And again, we don't like to use that term because families are very reluctant to use an antidepressant when you're telling them this is a real disease and it's not in your head. They say, what do you need an antidepressant, right? Mm-hmm. So the concept is that you're changing the synaptic transmission everywhere. And that's a very important aspect of this. So if you look at the pathophysiology, we have medications to change the peripheral interaction by changing the nerves. That could be antispasmodics, right? They, in a way, they are modulating my enteric plexus. It's not the classical neuromodulation, but still, if you are specific, they are. And all the new laxatives, we have the secretagogues. Mm-hmm. They all have an effect on the nerve perception and pain by mediating the neurotransmitters, right? So that's, to me, the effect of neuromodulation means you're just changing the transmission and the pain perception at different areas. Classically, coming back to your question, Jason, is people are saying the antidepressants is the classical neuromodulation, right? Because the antidepressants were the drugs that were used many, many years ago to change your brain chemistry and to try to modulate how your brain was working when you had anxiety and depression, right? And the classical antidepressants were used for that. The beauty of GI and DGBIs is that if you think about embryology, the intestine and the brain, everything is connected, right? The neural crest divides in the spine and in the brain and then sends ganglion cells to the myenteric plexus. So the neurotransmitters of the brain and the intestine are the same. And all of us know we have a lot of neurons in the GI tract. So when you're talking about using an antidepressant, which, you know, I'm not going to dwell on that term. We prefer to use neuromodulation by using a centrally acting agent. You are truly modulating also the periphery. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk more of the specific ones, but even amitriptyline has a peripheral effect. You know, you get constipation, you get other things. So you can do neuromodulation also in the periphery. And that's the important part. Now, I can tell you my bias is when you talk about neuromodulation, I think any technique that changes the nerves is neuromodulation. So I do think cognitive therapies neuromodulate. I think electrical stimulation neuromodulate. So we, peripheral auricular stimulation. I mean, we can use terms, but don't forget, we're all doing the same. We're resetting the software and trying to make the patients function better, right? In this particular topic today, we're talking about drugs that produce neuromodulation, right? And that's what we are doing.
Yeah, I really like that sort of framing of, you know, we're working on the transmission and reception of nerves, wherever they are, wherever we need to have that effect, and sort of framing it really broadly. And there are lots of modalities of therapy that can have that impact. And among them are medications. And within medications, some of them have central mediating activity, but that's not why we are choosing those medications necessarily. So I really like that framing.
Excellent. So I guess, speaking of framing, to frame our next discussion, we have a patient case for you. Probably someone that you see, I don't know, a few times a day in your clinic. So let's say we have a 16-year-old girl. She has anxiety. She comes to you with repeated episodes of cramping lower abdominal pain triggered by meals and stress. When she has pain, she has to go to the bathroom. When she goes to the bathroom, she feels a bit better. Her symptoms have persisted despite some of the maybe more basic things we do, like educating about the diagnosis, trying an antispasmodic. She's tried maybe some dietary modification. She's working with her psychologist on abdominal pain-focused CBT, but she's still struggling. And so it's affecting her school and her sports. So would you consider a trial of a neuromodulator medication for her? Like, what are the factors that go into that decision for you?
Important question, right? So I want to step back a little bit. I mean, the fact that you may or may not have anxiety does not push you to use neuromodulation. It may push you to see which neuromodulator I'm going to use. Mm-hmm. But the use of, in general, neuromodulation for pain has the concept that, particularly in this case, if the peripheral treatments have not worked, And in this case, you know, if you have constipation, I might have tried a secret agogue. But assuming you fight triggers and the diet didn't work, because coming back, you have to go stepwise, right? You accept the diagnosis, you look for triggers, you go stepwise slowly, because most patients don't have a severe central nervous system reset or sensitization, as we call it. You know, the adults have the term of central pain syndromes, right, which exist in pediatrics too. So in most of the patients we see in clinic, you may not need to use a central neuromodulator because you can treat the modulation of the periphery, right? So I always look at this as a stepwise. So I always try periphery first, and then you try to escalate, and then you try to do, you know, looking for the triggers, and then you start to do, okay, if that does not work, are there peripheral neuromodulators that are different that I can use for the pain? And then if that does not work, then you go to the central neuromodulators. I'm a big person to use cognitive therapies and hypnosis because I have access to them. Not everybody has access to them. But people have to understand those tend to be more effective than any of the other things we're going to talk about. And if you're really scientific, the pediatric literature shows the central neuromodulators like the antidepressants have never been shown in placebo-controlled trials to be effective, more effective than placebo. That doesn't mean we don't use them, but people need to come back from that and say, okay, something is different, right? And we can discuss that. But coming back to this particular patient, once you start to have a major problem with quality of life and missing on life and activities, as some of my patients tell me, I mean, my life movie and the movie is going around me, but I'm not in the movie, right? So once you start to see that, you need to be aggressive because what you really want to do is, you know, have the patient back to function. So yes, once they are more severe, I tend to use something to try to decrease the pain together with the cognitive therapies. You can say I'm augmenting the cognitive therapies. If you don't have a psychologist, people would say use a central neuromodulation first. And if that does work, then you need to augment it with psychological techniques. So don't forget all these things are synergistic and augment each other.
I like that. Now, the next question, I think you've already kind of answered this in a way in your earlier response, but if you are talking about central neuromodulation with a family and the family are quick on Google or they have some awareness and they say, well, that's an antidepressant, it can be challenging to explain why you're wanting to use what has classically been referred to as an antidepressant with their child who has abdominal pain. So how do you walk through that explanation to a family so that they understand the rationale that you have?
Well, it's a very important question. First, you know, I said I tried to get away from the name depression and for the anxiety part, because that's not a sine qua non. I always explain to them exactly what I told you, the embryology, we have the same neurotransmitters. I'm just trying to decrease the pain firing. And we always use the analogy in my clinic that, you know, the treatment of these patients is a tricycle. You know, one wheel of the tricycle is looking for the reason of the pain, which, you know, harmfulness, which usually you don't have anything, is very hurtful. So you're looking for triggers of the pain, right? That's how I frame testing. I'm looking for triggers of the pain. And then I do medical interventions to decrease how the pain is firing. And I talk a lot about hypersensitivity. And you should know that all these neuromodulators have a peripheral effect. And amitriptyline has been shown to decrease rectal sensation, for example. Gabapentin has shown to be the same. And then I say, you try to dumb down the nerves, right? Then we talk about the model of the central, the functional MRI that has shown all these changes in the circuitry, you know, of having increased pain perception, more awareness and inability to inhibit the pain. You know, I haven't even mentioned psychological things, right? Mm-hmm. And I say, and these medications change the chemistry and have been shown to change the circuits. So you have more pain, you feel more pain, and you're more aware of the pain. And that's the model of the disease. And these medicines are going to decrease that sensitivity. Of course, your arousal and your expectations and your catastrophizing are going to have an influence on how all this is going to be perceived, right? So these medicines may have an effect on that too, but I'm not doing it for that. I'm doing it more for the pain perception, and that's how I usually frame it to them.
Yeah, that's great.
I like that.
And so, of course, like, I know there's a lot of nuance to this, and, you know, I think our case may have simplified this a little bit, but, you know, when thinking about our case, what medication would you start with? And I know, of course, like you mentioned, there's not like a randomized controlled trial showing that one's more effective than another. I think a lot of this is based on, you know, experience and maybe a little bit of a preference. But what do you usually start with? And so we talk about a teenager. Does that change if they're younger or if there's other comorbidities? What do you usually do?
It's a very important question. So the important thing is that I think all of us have to be familiarized with the medicines we use.
Yeah.
That includes the secretagogues, that includes whatever, right? But when you use neuromodulation, my advice, and that's how I started, is you need to get familiarized with one or two, and you need to understand what the effects are, right? So if you look at the family of antidepressants, and that's what we're going to talk first, the family of antidepressants, you have different families, and they all have the same principle but different effects, right? So the overlying principle, and again, I mentioned this to the families too, is you have these monoamines that are abnormal in patients with pain and depression. It could be, you know, serotonin, noradrenaline, or dopamine. And every antidepressant was designed to change that. So if you look at the families of antidepressants, they have different effects on different receptors. So coming back to your question, how do I choose what to do? Depends on the main symptom and where else, what else do I see? And depending on what I want to achieve, I choose the medication. So what do I mean? If you look at the TCAs, the classical tricyclic antidepressants, you know, they inhibit this monoamine metabolism by increasing the levels by diminishing the uptake, right? The tricyclic antidepressants inhibit the uptake of both serotonin and noradrenaline. The SSRIs inhibit the uptake of only serotonin. They have no effect on noradrenaline. If you look at, you know, the SNRIs, they are very similar than the TCIs. They also inhibit the uptake of both serotonin and noradrenaline. But if you look at the tetracyclics like mirtazapine, they have an indirect effect through alpha ligands. It's a different pathway to increase noradrenaline and serotonin. So the safety profile is different. Now, you are going to ask me, what's the difference between them? For example, TCAs and SNRIs. Both are reuptake of both, but the TCAs are so nonspecific that they also have muscarinic effects. So they are going to give you anticholinergic effects. They have alpha adrenergic antagonism, so they can give you sleepiness and tiredness and dizzy. And they allow patients to sleep better, but they don't have a big effect on anxiety, for example. SSRIs have a much better effect on anxiety because it's very specific for serotonin. The mirtazapine, given the indirect effect, has a great effect on appetite, for example, and nausea, but doesn't have an effect on pain. So if you want to frame them, depending on what you're trying to achieve, these medicines have a different profile. So the SSRIs are very good for anxiety, not so good for pain, but TCAs and SNRIs are very good for pain. And tricyclics are very good when you want to achieve other things like constipation or other things. And then the quaternions, like the mirtazapine, those are very good for appetite and nausea.
Yeah, that's good. So I guess for this 16-year-old, you know, her primary problem is pain, fecal urgency. She does have this comorbid anxiety. What would you choose for her?
I think, you know, if she's already getting some CBT, mm-hmm. so you would have to check with the psychologist. The reason I say that is if you have other psychiatric illnesses, and a lot of my patients have OCD, for example, mm-hmm. You know, another comorbidities you need to decide. But if the patient really has mainly an anxiety driven, like you are describing to me, I would tend to do an SSRI.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to say, premise, the lack of evidence does not mean that we know that there's no evidence, right? If you look at the pediatric studies, there's one study of SSRIs that showed it was effective. And actually, SSRI in pediatric non-controlled experience has been shown to be effective in, you know, there's a study that did retrospective, 70% of patients responded. Of course, they are not controlled, right? So I tend to use an SSRI if there's a lot of anxiety. If the main problem is pain and there's not a lot of anxiety, for example, then I tend to go with amitriptyline mm-hmm. or a TCA. If that's they really have a lot of nausea, I would do mirtazapine. Now, that's my drug, and I don't mean to give you just pharmacological names, right? But we're talking about the family of the tetracyclics. And there's many studies that show that SNRIs like Cymbalta and duloxetine as useful as the TCAs without the side effects, but there's no studies in abdominal pain. That's why they are not used as much just because we don't have the experience, not because they are not so good.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this is a really great rundown. And I like the point that you made that although the literature does not show a lot of evidence, the absence of evidence isn't the evidence of absence for their effectiveness. But let's say, I'm going to twist our case just a little bit or tweak our case just a little bit. And let's say that this child presents and she is already on an SSRI prescribed by her primary care provider, or she has a psychiatrist who's looking after her for her anxiety. And these are her symptoms despite already being on an SSRI. How does that affect your approach and your next steps?
It's a great question, right? Because as you know, most of us are not psychiatrists. And even though I'm very familiar with these, sometimes it's very, very complicated, right? So when they have a psychiatrist on board, actually sometimes it's easier because you have somebody that knows more than you about these drugs to run by them and work with them, right? And we reach out to psychiatry all the time, even if they don't have it. But don't forget that you're asking me a question that I would reframe as, do you have any augmentation that you can do once you have something? Because it could be that they are on an SSRI, it could be that they are on a TCA, right? It could be that they are getting cognitive therapy. I think the concept is the same concept, right? So I'm sure Jason wants to come to the point that if you are not careful, you can create a lot of side effects in the patients. And there's something called serotonin syndrome that if you are not careful with the medicines and you're on an SSRI and you add a tricyclic and you inhibit more the uptake of serotonin, you're going to increase the serotonin levels even more. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful of the serotonin syndrome, which I've seen. So what I would say is if they're on a very good dose of an SSRI, I tend to use a different family. And this family is the family of the ligand, the delta ligand inhibitors, right? Which is gabapentin and pregabalin. And those have been shown to have two effects. They have an absolute peripheral effect, actually. And gabapentin has a more peripheral effect than central effect. And Lyric or pregabalin has a very central effect that allows you to augment the effect without changing the serotonin levels. So in a patient like this, we would tend to add something like gabapentin or Lyrica to the therapy. I have many patients on both low-dose tricyclics and low-dose SSRIs monitoring for the syndrome. But the two other things that you need to be cognizant about, a lot of these patients have ADHD medications and they come to you with amitriptyline and they have Zofran. Mm-hmm. And they have promethazine. So you have to be careful of QTC prolongation, which I've seen. Mm-hmm. So we tend to forget this polypharmacy sometimes creates more problems. Right. And don't forget, maybe we're going to talk about this, but I don't want to forget to mention. Don't forget when you give an antidepressant, you need to explain not only the side effects, but the black box warning, which really makes a lot of patients hesitate. Yeah, the black box warning indicates that people on antidepressants can get suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem, right?
Yeah.
So I always tell the families and we make it very clear. Everybody gets very concerned. Usually these are patients that are more depressed. So you give them the energy to do it. So it's very rare, but I've seen it. I've seen even depression with things like Motegrity, right, with prucalopride. So you have to always be cognizant of the side effects and what's going to happen to the patient.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point about the, first of all, understanding the class of medicine that you're using so that if somebody is well dosed on a particular class, but still not seeing the impact that you're looking for, that there are other classes and to focus on those. But also that important thing about, even though we are avoiding using the term antidepressant, we're making this less about the central CNS mood disorder that they have. It's important, families have access to information online. You never want to fail to provide very clear information, very important information that might be kind of a breach of faith if they were to see it on the pharmacy handout after they pick up the medication, they see that black box warning. So getting out in front of it and sharing that warning so that they're at least aware of the rare risk.
One follow-up question. So, there's so many, you mentioned QT prolongation and, so many of the medications we use, maybe they're on erythromycin as well, so many of these medications prolong the QT. I know there's a little bit of maybe variability in this, but if you are to start someone on amitriptyline, do you check an EKG beforehand? And Do you ever check it afterwards as well? What's your thought about that?
Two things, you know, before I moved on, when I was talking to Jason about when do you need to augment, don't forget, and I want to make the point, these medicines don't act immediately. So you cannot tell me after 2 days that it didn't work and then you need to add another medicine. So that's a very important concept to give to the families before you consider augmentation therapy, right? Most studies show that the pain gets better before the anxiety, for example. So that's positive, but still it can take 3 or 4 weeks. So the patients need to know that 2 weeks may not be enough for you to decide I need to do something, either increase the dose or augment the dose. Coming back to Peter's question, there's studies about this. I know amitriptyline has a major effect on the heart because of the sodium channels. So I always get a baseline EKG. If the EKG at baseline is normal, I use amitriptyline and I don't get a follow-up EKG. The studies have shown it's not cost effective and you don't have the problem. Unless they come to me and say, I gave Zofran, I'm giving it. If they start to use medicines that I didn't prescribe that can have an effect, then I always check to be sure there's no side effect of this augmentation. I know some people check an EKG all the time. I don't. I just do baseline.
Yeah.
I think that's important. I always do the same too, that you do a baseline. I have to admit, I often will do a follow-up if the QTC is a little bit borderline on the initial, but if it's totally normal, then that's the last one I do for sure.
Don't forget, you can measure levels of amitriptyline now. I don't do it routinely, but if a patient is not responding, you can do that. And in patients that really don't respond to anything and have a lot of side effects, we do a lot of pharmacogenomics, right? We send these, you can measure all the cytochromes and see, and you'll find that there's some families and preferences that you can really tailor the antidepressant. This I would not do on my own. I usually do it with a psychiatrist and the pharmacological things, but some kids are so difficult that you need to know that those tools exist.
And I guess you had mentioned before, you know, that you can, it can take 3-4 weeks to see kind of the full effect of many of these medications. So when do you, how do you usually tell them you're going to look at that effect? Like, is there a certain amount of time you say we have to be on it for 1 month before we decide if it's helpful or not? How long do you ask them to continue before you consider changing?
A very important question. So remember I talked to you about the tricycle? Mm-hmm. I didn't tell you what the other two wheels were. So one wheel was the medical wheel. The other wheel is the psychological support wheel. Right? So the cognitive therapy is the catastrophizing. But the third wheel is physical therapy and functioning. So I always frame it that in our own studies, the functioning is going to come back before the pain gets controlled. Mm-hmm. And having pain does not mean you don't function. So we start to push them to function immediately. We do reintegration plans at school. Of course, they cannot go to school right away, but we do 1 hour. And so we start to push them to function, even if they have pain. And we find that that is usually very helpful. And expectations are important. We always tell them, we'll be available by the phone. I am very lucky to have a team that can follow up to see these patients because we do, a lot of follow-ups as soon as we start these medications. But we tell them, you have to be patient. It's not going to be magic. We always give them rescue medications too. I find that that helps, even though the rescue may not be so efficient. But if the families have something to do and they feel that you are giving them a way out when the pain is there, because we tell them you are still going to have a lot of pain and I don't want you to go to the emergency room, right?
Right.
One thing that I failed to mention before when you asked me about the medications, and I just remember that, is don't forget there's other atypical neuromodulation we do with medications that are not in the family of antidepressants. I use a lot of ciproheptadine. And I don't want to leave this podcast without mentioning, that's probably my first line. Before I start to use an antidepressant, I use ciproheptadine, which has been shown by changing the levels of the histamine. And, it's also a serotonin antagonist. Can have a very important effect on pain and on nausea and on headaches. Big caveat, don't forget, you don't want to increase appetite in a patient that has an eating disorder or ARFID or something, because then you're going to create more anxiety. Yeah. But if there's nothing in that, I tend to use ciproheptadine before I use an antidepressant, right?
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up. I actually asked Peter ahead of time when we were reviewing these questions about where should we slot ciproheptadine into the discussion. So I'm glad you brought that up. So I think we've covered, we talked a lot about sort of an approach to deciding when to start neuromodulator medications, we talked about that augmentation idea about what are you adding to get the effect that you're looking for, and that's really important. We talked about how you choose specific neuromodulator medications based on the symptom profile of the child that you're seeing. You know, do they have anxiety? Are there more issues with nausea and poor appetite? Are there issues with, is it pain predominant? So that's really, really important. But I guess we talked a little bit about side effects in the sense of not wanting to avoid them by mixing medications of the same class or even of different classes. But that is one of the reasons why pediatric gastroenterologists may be leery about wading into prescribing neuromodulator medications is because they're not comfortable with those side effects or out of concern for those side effects. So what's been your experience with side effects with these medications, and what are the specific things that we should be watching for, you know, in addition to things that we've already mentioned?
It's a super important question. And, you know, I want to tell the pediatric GI community, if you look at the pediatric community, general practitioners, pediatricians are very comfortable doing these medications, right? And UCGIs don't want to do it, and they send them back to the pediatrician who does it, right? So it's a matter of education and getting familiar with this. And I think this day and age that we know a lot about DGBIs and the safety profiles of these medications, I don't think a quaternary referral is necessary for you to start a low-dose neuromodulation, or if you want to say a low-dose antidepressant. We always say about the suicidal ideation, have I seen it? Yes, it's very rare. We don't do that. But we see other effects, that they are very sleepy. Some people, you know, see that constipation, especially with the TCAs, can be a problem. But in general, and some people just don't feel themselves, right? Those are the biggest things that we find. And in general, you just step back and then you either stop it or change it.
Yeah.
And the other important thing, actually, the study show if you do low dose, which is what we do in amitriptyline, for example, you start slow and then you're going to get used to the side effects. So that's another important point. Mm-hmm. A mild side effect is not a reason to stop, because most of the time the patients will get used to that. And that has been shown in some of the prospective studies, even with ciproheptadine, right? I tend to be very conservative and start with a quarter of the dose and then I advance it slowly. There's like a tolerance that develops. So that needs to be one of the reassurances to give to the families.
Yeah, I always warn families when I'm starting ciproheptadine that the child may be sleepy, but to persist, because it often gets better after a week or so, and it allows them to stay on a medication that they might otherwise abandon.
Ciproheptadine must be like, overall, the pediatric GIs, if they had to vote for their favorite medication, that's got to be it. Shocking it's not more widely used in adult medicine, but probably has to do with appetite, I guess, and weight gain.
Don't forget, seizure thresholds can change. And, you know, if you talk to neurologists, sometimes they are worried about doing that. And don't forget the eating disorder patient, the typical ARFID with DGBI we see now. So always remember, don't increase the appetite, as I mentioned before.
Yeah.
For sure.
You know, one bonus question that I want to just throw out there, because you've alluded to, you know, so for example, like imipenem, the multi-center randomized clinical trial, even though the majority of kids responded, it wasn't any greater than placebo. And it kind of emphasizes the high response rate to placebo. And so, of course, you did a study on non-deceptive placebo and how that can be effective on its own. You know, telling families this is placebo or this, but this is something that's been shown in studies to be very effective for this disorder. How do you apply that to your practice? I mean, I don't know. I'm sure you probably don't actually prescribe placebo, but is that something you mention, or what do you think about? Is that something you apply to, you had mentioned having a rescue. So even though we know maybe this is not going to fix everything, maybe that's enough just to help comfort the family. What do you think about that?
If you backtrack, I think if you look at all the clinical trials, so in pediatrics in general, you can look at lubiprostone, Motegrity, the amitriptyline. The profile of response was very similar to what you see in adults. What made it not significant is like all the time, right? It has to do with the sample size and who are you competing with.
Right.
So given that we have such a high placebo response, you know, these medications shown not to be effective. I mean, the amitriptyline in our study was effective 60% of the time. Mm-hmm. That's not a minor number.
Right.
But was it, as they say, was it a Norco effect? I mean, it's hard to know, right? But that's the problem. So placebo is very powerful, as Peter is saying. We've shown that the placebo effect, and in general, in DGBIs, is 40 to 50%. And the drug companies are trying to minimize the placebo effect by doing different designs. Mm-hmm. My assessment is, given our findings, that when you do open placebo, meaning, as Peter said, the patients knew, and the parents, not only the patient, the parents knew I was giving them an inert substance, and they still got better, mm-hmm. shows you the power of the body-mind interaction and how you can change your expectations and your, you know, what you want to have. So my dream is that in the future, we're going to have the ethical ability to do open placebo. As you know, to do open placebo in clinical medicine is very complicated.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of ethical concerns. And if you do it with no deception, there's no problem. But if you do placebo, you know it's placebo, but you don't tell the family, that's not ethical, right? Having said that, I'm sure in GI, we use a lot of medicines that are having a big placebo effect, like H2 blockers, PPIs in certain conditions. I'm sure the antispasmodics here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But yes, the expectation of the family is very important. But I learned that harnessing the placebo effect means also being positive, explaining them the gut-brain interaction and how your own expectations and approach to the problem is going to help you.
Right.
That's great. I do like the idea of the impact of even open, non-deceptive, like non-deceptive placebo, that you can tell people, or at least the parents, this is nothing, but the child needs to believe that it may be useful, that it can be very powerful in this disorder, and it can still have a really big impact.
An interesting anecdote. Patients would call in the trial, Dr. Nurko, you're giving me the placebo, can I take more? Because it's really helping me.
Wow.
Then we stopped the trial after the 3 months. Yeah. And then many patients relapsed. So I had to get an IRB extension to be able to give open placebo for a year.
Oh my gosh.
For these patients, because the placebo is very powerful. I mean, it's just, we know nothing about these things, which actually I can use also. You did not ask me, but it's a very important for people. Once you do an antidepressant or a neuromodulator and it works, how long do you keep it? Because that's a question that we all face all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And again, there's no information. There's information in depression that shows that once you respond to depression therapy, you have to keep the treatment from 6 to 12 months after response.
Wow. Right.
Because if you withdraw it too soon, they're going to relapse.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that has been borrowed into the DGBI literature. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the adult recommendations and what I do, people recommend after you respond, you need to stay on the same medications for 6 to 12 months. Mm-hmm. And depending on the circumstances, you are going to say, how do I know? I mean, if they're going to have graduation and prom and other things, then I don't stop it. But if they don't, then I may, after 6 months, start to withdraw it. Yeah. So, but you don't do it too soon because then people relapse, right? Clinical evidence. This is just from the depression literature.
Thanks for bringing that up. I think that is really important that we have the what to do next. You know, we've talked to a lot of these questions were, okay, they're still having symptoms. Now what? They're still having symptoms. Now what? It's also really important to say they're better. Now what?
Right. All right. So that was such a good, and like, of course we could go on and on about this. That was such a good conversation. But we will have to wrap it up eventually. And so one thing we want to ask you, so from your perspective on this topic, this important topic, you know, what are your 3 key takeaways from this conversation?
I think the most important is communication and how you give the diagnosis and the testing from a practical point of view, right? So I think we can just go back to where we started. You have to acknowledge the pain is real, and this is a positive diagnosis that's not in your head. And I'm going to do tests to look for triggers, not the reason. And to me, that would be the most important thing. And then these patients need a lot of communication and being there. A lot of patients, we've done questionnaires, right, in our patients. What they appreciate more is to get a firm diagnosis and a pathway forward, mm-hmm. even though it may be rocky. Once you say, I don't know what it is, it's a mystery. Once they feel there's no direction, then it's very complicated. So that would be my advice. And this is something you don't need extra time in the clinic to just frame things the same way before you send it to a center that's going to spend time with these more intractable patients.
No, those are great messages to sink home for people, especially that it doesn't take necessarily more time to do things in a more therapeutic way than another way. I think that's important. So this has been so good talking to you, Dr. Nurko, about all of these medications and the approach to therapy in this population. If we could switch gears a little bit and look back at your career, what would you say has been the most valuable advice that you've received? And what advice would you have for our listeners?
If you look back, as I mentioned before, our pathways are not a straight line, and there's a lot of, you know, obstacles and ups and downs, right? The best advice I received was to follow your heart and to follow your passion and to be perseverant, right? And I think most of our lives are a testament to that. And I think the advice I could give to people is very similar to that, right? I would say you need to know what you want. Don't go into a field just because there's an opening. You need to be passionate about what you do. And you have to perseverate. If you have an idea, you have to perseverate. If you know, people write grants, sometimes you need to write 50 grants before you get funded, right? So don't give up. The fact that people don't appreciate what you're doing, that does not mean you're wrong. I'm not saying you should be insensible, right? If I want to climb Everest tomorrow, no matter how much I want, I'm not going to be able to do it. So you have to be perseverant and continue, but you have to be realistic and you have to look back and say, okay, are my goals doable or not doable? The other big advice is I think you need to surround yourself by mentors and sponsors. And your mentors don't have to be one person. And that's something else I was lucky at the beginning of my career to have mentors. But I think having the right mentorship that's going to help you, guide you, and support you is very important. And then you need sponsors to be able to help you break into the field, right? And I've been very lucky both ways. And there's nothing better to me than to see that people that were my mentees are much better than me now. And then I have to ask them for sponsorship, right? So that's great. That's great to see.
Oh, that's great. Awesome. I think like, you know, thinking about the young Dr. Nurko applying for residency didn't match to now being, you know, at the top of the field, you know, I feel like, right, your words about perseverance, I think is such an important thing.
I may say another thing that may be politically complicated. As a foreigner, you mentioned that you've heard a lot of gratitude and things. One thing I learned, and I would give an advice to the young immigrants, don't divide yourself. You are here because you deserve to be here. Most of us were just grateful to have the opportunity to do the minimum. Mm-hmm. No, advocate for yourself. Even though you're an immigrant and they are giving you the opportunity, and I'm super grateful to the U.S. for the opportunity, you still can advocate for yourself. You know, most of us were just grateful to be there, and we didn't pursue the negotiating skills that other people, American-born people, had compared to what I had. You know, I was just grateful. Other people were really mad. So that's my other advice. Don't devalue. And yes, you're here and you should be grateful, but you deserve it.
Right.
So be an advocate for yourself, right? And that may apply for everybody, not only immigrants, right? So.
But that's a great point. I mean, if anything, absolutely. I think many international medical grads, they've worked harder to get there, you know, than someone who is, you know, born in this country. But anyways, thanks again so much. That was such a great conversation. We'll have to do this again. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Honored that you allowed me to participate, so thank you.
It was about time. Man, we had an awesome time talking to Dr. Nurko. So now thank him so much for taking the time out of his busy day to sit down with us. And I'm sure our listeners enjoyed that as much as we did.
Absolutely. This is one of the I'm going to sit down and re-listen to, you know, periodically to get set in my mind that approach to communicating with families about these medications.
As usual, if you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @BattleSounds and on Facebook at @PediatricJPodcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. If you like what you heard and want to support the podcast, it would really help us out if you did one or all of the following three things. One, tell one or more people about the podcast. Two, leave a review at Apple Podcasts to help others discover our podcast. And three, on our Buzzsprout page, there's a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. You can also get there through www.naspghan or naspghan.org. The money you donate helps support some of the amazing things the NASPGHAN Foundation is doing, including supporting pediatric GI research and public education programs.
As always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the hosts and guest and are subject to change with advances in the field.
Thanks for listening. Jason, you did it.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Woo-hoo. Oh, God.